Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. How will China's economic expansion change the world? Although many U.S. leaders have worried about China's growing share of American debt and potential for military aggression, my guest today argues that the greater concern should be the ways in which China is crafting an alternative model of capitalism that bypasses democracy in service to economic growth. And that model is understandably attractive to states in the developing world, which see China as an example of financial prosperity without concessions to freedom or human rights. Stefan Halper is Senior Fellow in the Department of International Studies at Cambridge University and a State Department veteran who served under President Nixon, Ford, and Reagan. His new book is The Beijing Consensus, How China's Authoritarian Model Will Dominate the 21st Century. Steph, welcome to Think.
Thank you very much. It's great to be with you.
Let's start with the obvious. What is the Beijing Consensus, and how does it relate to the Washington Consensus?
Well, the Washington Consensus was an idea advanced by the World Bank and the International Monetary Fund in the 80s. That that said essentially that developing countries needed to try to free the markets, reduce the size of government, liberalize the regulations that governed commerce, and that through these kinds of new flexibility, growth would emerge, literacy would improve, that you would see better rates of infant mortality, and so on. What turned out at the end of the 80s is that many of the countries in Africa, Latin America, and the Near East found that they were actually going backwards, that their education levels had not improved, that their income had not improved. And so there was a general disillusionment with the Washington Consensus. That left an open door for China. China came in and said, essentially, that they could provide low or no-cost loans, that they would help to manage infrastructure development, that they'd make some investments in hospitals and schools, that you didn't have to have an open public square, and that this would lead to more rapid development. And what we've seen is that in many of the countries beyond the West, this kind of model is very attractive. It's attractive to regime leaders who don't want to have to deal with a raucous legislature or a difficult media, and it does produce growth.
Because while U.S. aid comes with a lot of strings attached that you just mentioned, the only concessions that China really cares about are that states that borrow money from it or receive aid from it don't acknowledge Tibet and Taiwan. Is that correct?
Yes, they have a little list, and it's Tibet and Taiwan, but also human rights. They want support on issues related to the South China Sea, for example. The United States and other countries, Vietnam, Philippines, and so on, are concerned about keeping the sea lanes open. And the Chinese are making claims at this time about having access to and dominating the commercial assets in the South China Sea. So this has become an issue. It's a rising issue, and the Chinese are pressuring the people they do business with to support them on this. There's another area that they do exert pressure, and it has to do with the World Trade Organization. The Chinese want to be regarded as a market economy, not as a planned economy, because if they are, then any fines imposed for what's called dumping are much less. So all of it is commercially driven, but those are the hot points.
Now, some experts have argued that China so longs for the respect of the West, and maybe that plays into a little bit of what you were just talking about, but so longs for that respect that it might be willing to sever ties with rogue states if conditions were right. Why do you disagree with that?
Well, actually, China has, when the going gets really tense, as it did over Darfur and Sudan, China backed off at the end and stopped its massive provision of military equipment and advisors to the Sudanese government. It just became too embarrassing for the Chinese. When China was caught red-handed providing intelligence and secret police procedures to the Zimbabwe regime, when that became public, they backed away from it. The reason is that China's greatest weak point, I mean, their greatest vulnerability, has to do with the broad perception that their policies lack an ethical and moral base, that they're simply interested in commerce and profit and efficiency. And given that circumstance, it's very hard for them to occupy a seat at the top table on the global stage. It's the reason that Tibet is so difficult for them. Anytime there's a confrontation between Tibet and Beijing, Beijing loses. It loses in the eyes of the world. The Chinese are dragged around the front pages of newspapers above the crease and regarded as behaving badly. And so this is a vulnerability China has. They don't know how to deal with it, but they are very sensitive to it.
On the other hand, you do not see China as having any real appetite for conflict with the West. Is that because it doesn't need to fight us militarily, or because such a fight would ultimately impede Chinese economic growth, or both?
I was in Beijing recently, and I was just shocked to have someone say to me, look, you guys do the fighting in the Middle East, we'll do the business. And that was their view. I mean, their view essentially is, no, they don't really want to confront us. It would be expensive. They're not sure they could win. They don't have the kind of support for it domestically that they think they need. And they believe that they can come out ahead in the long run by effecting these very lucrative commercial arrangements in Africa, Latin America, and other developing areas. There is, however, recently, a more confident, if not aggressive, quality to Chinese interaction. You see them gaining great confidence as a result of the difficulties the United States and the West have had in the recent recession. A senior Chinese leader in London not long ago said, now the teachers have problems, meaning that, you know, somehow the experts in capitalism had not properly regulated their economies and that they had gone off the rails and were now suffering from it. You also see this new sense of very strong confidence expressed in military exchanges. You know, the Chinese have ceased the military-to-military contacts we had with them for over two decades. We're no longer having those meetings. And, of course, the Chinese say it's because of the arms sales to Taiwan, but there's also a greater confidence on the part of the Chinese military that maybe they don't really have to deal with the United States or others when it comes to issues in the Western Pacific. So, you know, you're right, your basic point is correct, but there are changes around the edges.
Steph, talk a little bit about how authoritarian capitalism works in China. How, for example, do the state and business interests divide power and wealth there?
Well, what you have essentially is a single-party state which runs an authoritarian political process. That means that essentially the Communist Party rules with an iron fist. That doesn't mean that the party is inflexible, because it is very flexible. It invites businessmen, rural and urban people, professionals and workers all into the party. The party becomes a kind of a collection of elites and a network of people who support each other. And its principal purpose is to remain in power. It has lost a great deal, if not all, of its ideological impetus. It doesn't talk about Marxist-Leninism, for example, but it's kind of got a bland socialism that it does talk about, a social safety net, things like that. And under that sort of platform comes a vibrant entrepreneurial capitalist community. Now, Chinese businesses are often partly owned by the government. Many of them are actually partly owned by the People's Liberation Army. Other parts of the capitalist system or the entrepreneurial community are wholly separate from the government. But the government supports its entrepreneurs through a careful provision of credit and finance and, in some cases, management assistance. It's created a rising middle class. It's created a lot of curious and energetic people on the internet. It has generated millions of Chinese traveling abroad. And you might say, well, doesn't that exert pressure on the regime to democratize or to change? And the answer is, yes, it does. But this is a measure of the party's flexibility. It has managed to remain in control by very adroit decisions on where to draw the line and where to allow flexibility. So it's a very interesting combination of the state using the energy, the creativity, and the power of the market to generate profits, which then it, of course, collects in part through, if it's partly an owner of these businesses, and it also collects taxes. And if you look, for example, at the largest oil companies in the world today, you'll see it's not just China that has heavy state involvement. You have a similar situation in Russia and obviously in Saudi.
What sort of regulations does China place on its corporations right now in terms of their behavior, not only in terms of how they are assessed by the government for revenues?
What kind of regulations do they place on them?
Yeah.
Well, they're not very strong on intellectual property. They don't recognize that intellectual property is actually property. So you don't have that kind of stricture. There is an increasing adherence to the rule of law. They have found that they can't really do business internationally if other countries and other foreign businesses can't rely on the law. So they have gotten a lot better about that. They're also becoming better on adhering to international rules of accountancy. And that's something which is a welcome improvement on the part of the international business community. But they really do regulate their businesses very carefully, mainly through the provision of credit, but they don't interfere all that much in the management. So I think that you'd have to see it that way.
Stefan Halper is my guest. He's senior fellow in the Department of International Studies at Cambridge University and author of the new book, The Beijing Consensus, How China's Authoritarian Model Will Dominate the 21st Century. Join the conversation now by calling us at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies, an interdisciplinary degree catering to professional adults. You can pursue your passions and become an informed leader in your world. You can learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Stefan Halper. He is Senior Fellow in the Department of International Studies at Cambridge University and author of the new book, The Beijing Consensus, How China's Authoritarian Model Will Dominate the 21st Century. Join us by calling 1-800-933-5372 or by sending email to think@kera.org. Steph, it makes sense, logical sense, that hundreds of millions of Chinese citizens who once would have been completely shut out of ascension into the middle classes now can hope for that under the kind of economic growth that China has seen in recent decades. But from what we know about economies, that growth can't continue indefinitely at the rates that we've seen. Will the Chinese Communist Party have problems maintaining its stronghold in the inevitable event that that growth falls off?
I would have thought so, Chris. What you have is somewhere between 300 and 400 million people who are either in the middle class or moving into the middle class. And these are people who want their kids to go to really good schools, who are trying to buy condominiums or small houses in the larger cities and around the suburbs of Shanghai and Beijing and so on. There are people who want, who understand the American dream, who want to live effectively the American dream by having all of the qualities of an American middle class life. Now, at some point, the quest for material well-being and information and travel and flexibility will run into limitations imposed by the party. The party has been remarkably flexible in trying to accommodate this surge of aspiration, really, on the part of all these people. I don't know how long it can go on. It's just very hard to say. But it's not easy to manage growth in this kind of situation. For example, today, China has a shortage of laborers on the east coast of China. They've had to increase wage rates by 20% in many cases, and in a couple of cases, which highly publicized in the newspapers this week, Honda, for example, had to go up 25%, and another company went up 50% in order to get workers who could who would be willing to work in these long assembly lines. That could price Chinese products out of their niche, which has been low-cost consumer goods sold throughout Africa and the world beyond the West. And even in the United States, through Walmart and other places, you could see the cost of things made in China going up the way they did some years ago, for the cost of items made in Japan. I'm not sure how long this can last. The Chinese are very nervous about it.
Well, and when you talk about the labor shortage, I think immediately about the one-child policy, and you've got this aging population of workers that is not balanced by younger workers being born and entering the workforce.
That's exactly right. I mean, that is exactly right. They imposed a one-child policy. It was obviously, in order to reduce this immense population of what is now 1.4 billion people, and they have an aging population that's going to have to be supported by something. Now, they just don't have enough workers to do that. Of course, that crisis, such as it is not coming on for another 10 or 12 years. But it certainly does loom. All the same, you've got to remember, China has the largest hard currency reserve on this earth, with well over $2 trillion of hard currency reserve, meaning they've got savings, they have funds of that magnitude, which can be used for various projects and obviously for pensions and welfare for older people.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone numbers. Let's go to the phones now. We'll speak first with Ed in Flower Mound. Hi, Ed.
Chris, wonderful show once again.
Thank you.
One of the things that I've wondered about is comparing post-World War America as far as work ethic and opportunity, capitalization, incentive to China as it is now. Could you just comment on that, please?
Well, that is a really great question. I think that there is a similarity. After World War II, Americans wanted to get back on track. They wanted to reacquire their well-being, and they moved quickly into the 1950s, which was the really the flowering of middle-class America. The Chinese are entering this or moving through this period with higher levels of literacy, larger numbers of university graduates, and therefore more innovation and creativity in the commercial world. They're wanting to move into better housing. They want better schools, and they're pushing their government to provide more resources for quality of life questions in China, like environmental issues, for example, which have become very, very important with the largest, when 2008, they became the largest carbon polluters on Earth, mainly because of the number of cars they have. But, you know, there's a quality of life emphasis, just as you would expect to find in rising middle class communities and other places.
Well, to take that comparison one step further, in the 1950s in this country, when we saw the flowering of the middle class, we also saw a burgeoning movement for full civil rights for minorities in this country. There was the women's movement, things that we associate with equality and democracy. Do you imagine that China's minorities might look at this time of growth and imagine that it's the perfect time to stand up and demand their own rights?
Well, again, Chris, that's a really good point. I mean, one of the problems China has, one of its most difficult policy problems, is the inability to incorporate minorities into mainstream life. There are some 55 minority groups in China, but there's one dominant group, the Han, who are what we think of as being Chinese. But there are Uyghurs, there are Tibetans. There are others who are routinely discriminated against. What do I mean by that? Well, if you're a Tibetan, you cannot take university entrance examinations in Tibetan. You've got to take it in Chinese. That means that as you go into secondary and high school, you had better learn Chinese and stop learning in Tibetan, or you won't be able to pass the entry examinations.
Which is ultimately a cultural accommodation to make them more Han Chinese.
That's exactly right. I mean, it goes further than that. Just stay with Tibet for a minute. What the Han have done is they've flooded Tibet with millions upon millions of Han who now dominate the business, the local government, and really all of the demographics. The increase has been so dramatic that only about 8% of the people living in what we call Tibet are actually Tibetans. The rest of them are Han. So the Chinese have addressed the minority problem by attempting to subsume and deny the cultural attributes of these different ethnic groups. They haven't provided the opportunity that the United States or many Western European countries have for people to enter the system, have language training, skills development, job placement, tolerance as far as their differences, an embrace of diversity. You don't have that kind of thing in China.
We have an email here from Kitsy who asks, what is the status of women in terms of workplace equality in China? Is it more like the U.S. or more like Japan?
The problem, women are emerging pretty quickly now as that is to say, they're gaining some self-awareness and presenting themselves in terms of a cluster of women's related issues. But there is still vast discrimination against women in management positions. Chinese men are very hesitant to take direction from Chinese women. And there is a very firm glass ceiling. And so the heads of corporations and the heads of banks and so on are not women. There are, however, some, I mean, in some areas you find women who are at the top of their organizations, but they're mainly in the arts and fashion, and in a few cases in property development. But they're way behind in that sense. It's very, very much more of a traditional non-Western concept of a woman's role.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Next on the line, we have Scott in Plano. Hello, Scott.
Hi. I heard your discussion of the difficulties China will face as growth continues there. I've also heard people in general kind of imply, though, that China is likely to follow the model of, say, Korea, Taiwan, that were very authoritarian but capitalistic and then over time loosened their political systems. Do you think that's a good model, or how does China, your sense of China, Chinese capitalism, differ from what Korea and Taiwan had?
Well, the first point is that the caller is correct in that the so-called Asian model of development, which is what China has in a rather advanced stage, this all began in the 1930s with the Japanese in Manchuria, at that time called Manchukuo. And this form of economic organization was adapted by the Koreans, then by Singapore, Taiwan, and now China. And you're quite right. It's an authoritarian form of government. It does use the market. It's export-oriented. There are high savings rates. There are high levels of literacy and so on. The difference with China is the very sophisticated security structures that they have in place. There are several layers of security in China, block or police, the People's Armed Police, the Ministry of the Interior, the MSS, and you really can't get very far off the page without being identified. For example, there are 40,000 internet police in Beijing alone. What does that mean? It means that people want to have individual lives, and they want their privacy. They want flexibility, and this decision, the decision on how far they go, is very much in the hands of the authorities. It is for this reason that I am not optimistic that you're going to see democracy emerge in China anytime soon. There has been an assumption in Washington for 30 years that a dynamic market necessarily leads to people who have interests. They form political factions. They form political parties. You've got pluralism and then democracy. The Chinese interrupt that process at the point when people have interests, try to form factions, political factions. If you stand up in Tiananmen Square in Beijing and you have a sign that says, you know, vote X, do whatever, that's fine. Nobody will really bother you. But if another person with the same sign stands up in Shanghai, so that it looks like you're linked together, you'll both be arrested.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Next up is Ken in Plano. Hi, Ken.
Yes, hi. What a fascinating discussion. My question is, have you given any thought to whether there are different types of human beings on this planet? Do we all need this freedom? Or I was wondering if you could just speak to, you know, the two systems, American capitalism,
yeah,
totalitarian capitalism. Plato talked about this in The Republic, you know, society. Just talk a little bit about that. I hope that wasn't
too
general.
There's an element of what you're saying that is not quite, let me just put it this way. China is a Confucian society, and that means that the responsibility of the people let me start this way. The responsibility of the ruler is to provide the people with shelter, sustenance, and security. That's what he has to do for the people he's ruling. And the responsibility of the people is to obey the ruler. And so you don't have the kind of negotiated arrangement that you find in the West where, you know, there's a social contract, you have an open public square, you have freedom of speech, of assembly, of belief, and so on, and it's effectively a negotiation as to how you go forward. So when you ask if there are different kinds of people, I would say to you that there are very different political cultures and different expectations, and that it is entirely possible for this very large population not to feel they have to demand a role in making the decisions on where their society goes. They are broadly content to follow the leadership so long as they have hopes of a better future, a job, security, enough to eat, a good place to live, that sort of thing.
It does leave them pretty dependent on the assumption that their ruler is essentially a benevolent figure.
It really does. And look what you have for the ruler. I mean, you've got Hu Jintao, who is gray on gray. There's nothing terribly exciting about him. He's totally predictable. He's a party man from Shanghai. And before him, Jiang Zemin. These are the kind of gray personalities that these people feel able to support.
Stefan Halper is my guest. He is senior fellow in the Department of International Studies at Cambridge University and author of the new book, The Beijing Consensus, How China's Authoritarian Model Will Dominate the 21st Century. You're welcome to join the conversation now. Just give us a call at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies, an interdisciplinary degree catering to professional adults. You can pursue your passions and become an informed leader in your world. You can learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is senior fellow in the Department of International Studies at Cambridge, Stefan Halper. His new book is called The Beijing Consensus, How China's Authoritarian Model Will Dominate the 21st Century. Join us by sending email to think@kera.org or calling 1-800-933-5372. I realize we could spend literally hours on this question alone, but maybe briefly, you could characterize for us contemporary Chinese diplomacy in light of what we're talking about here.
Chris, I would like to do that, but I there's something I'd like to actually say, if you don't mind.
Sure.
You asked me early on what the Beijing consensus was, and I wanted to add a little bit to that because the core point that I'm making in this book is that the relationships that China is developing around the world are relationships in which China does not expect or urge or require any type of representative government on the part of its partners, the people it does business with. It's quite happy for these governments to have authoritarian, even dictatorial structures. And so what is conveyed by this relationship is China's total disinterest in public debate, in freedoms of speech, assembly, and belief, in the welfare of the individual in these countries. And the consensus that's being formed is the one among these various leaders and China to begin to advance values in the United Nations and in other international organizations which are antithetical. They are inconsistent with the values that have informed Western progress over two centuries. So what I'm saying here is that there is emerging a battle of ideas in which China's concept of governance and our concept of governance are clearly very different. And the Chinese, the appeal of China's model or its example is here is a third world country that's risen to the heights of global status and power, and they've done it without democracy, and they've done it without having to deal with a media and a legislature that's troublesome. And that ought to be a wake-up call for this country to see how many other countries are embracing this form of government. My view is that this is one of the greatest challenges, if not the greatest challenge, that we have confronted since the Cold War, because this is a system of government which is very different, in fact, quite hostile to the values that we have in the United States. So I just wanted to make that point.
Well, and I think you actually spoke a lot to Chinese foreign policy and diplomacy in that statement. Let's talk about that a little more, because to the extent that we remain the largest export partner that China has and probably will for the foreseeable future, despite the Washington consensus, has that been a failure where the Beijing consensus will be a success?
Well, we have some leverage over China. And it is simply this. If the United States, for example, insists that China increase the value of their currency called the yuan so that it is a fair value, right now it's between 20 and 40% undervalued, and that we've been asking them to do this now for years, and if they refuse to do it, and we put tariffs on imports to the United States, this will cause massive unemployment in China, which is one of the things they fear the most, because these people turned out into the streets will create chaos. So there is some leverage in the United States. People say, well, they own our debt. They control our actions by virtue of this. You don't argue with your banker and so on. That's an oversimplification, which is not actually correct. We have about as much leverage, perhaps more, in the economic realm than they do.
And the reason that we haven't exercised that leverage is because, as you also argue in the book, U.S. and Western leaders really haven't recognized this issue for what it is?
That's right. I mean, what's happened, it's a stealth issue. It's come up very, very quietly. We haven't realized the implications of China's advances in the third world and its promotion of this approach to government. It's come up very quickly, and it's come up very quietly. We can manage the economic relationship. As I've said in the book, it's a marriage of liabilities. Yes, they own our debt, but yes, we can control employment to some degree, and we can create social chaos if we absolutely have to. We don't want to, obviously. And on the military side, we have the ability to project power into the Western Pacific, and the Chinese know it. What we haven't been able to get our hands around is how to counter the Chinese, this battle of ideas about government. And the one thing I haven't mentioned is that in order for these projects to go smoothly in Africa, Latin America, Near East, and so on, the Chinese pay massive under-the-table payments to the leaders of these countries, and I mean in the $500 million range, to chiefs of state to be sure things go smoothly. This is not just speculation. I mean, it's public, pretty well public knowledge. So it's very hard for American companies and American even government's initiatives to compete with that sort of thing, because we don't do that, at least not that I know of. So you can see this is a pretty tough problem.
Well, what role do you see for states that have good relationships with the United States and are important trading partners with China and are democracies like India and Japan and Australia in terms of keeping China in check?
Well, I think they have a huge role. I think that one of the things that's hugely important is for the United States, Australia, and Japan to draw together to keep the sea lines of communications open. And the Navy actually views the space from the east coast of Africa across the Indian Ocean through the Malaccan Straits and up to the coast of Korea. They see that as all one battle space. And that is the sea lane that has to be kept open, and it's the sea lane that China, it appears, is moving to choke off in the South China Sea. So Japan, Australia, India, and the United States have a major role in that respect. But we have other things. When we talk about environmental quality or quality of the sea, when we talk about agreements for gas and oil deposits under the seabed, those countries that I've mentioned, U.S., Australia, Japan, Singapore, Malaysia, have to come together to form a kind of a forum that looks at these issues and invite China in to be part of it. Chinese hate to be left out. They don't like to lose face. They want to be thought to be important. So they should be drawn into these processes, and that's one way of encouraging rational behavior on their part.
Let's go back to the phones now at 800-933-5372. This time we'll speak with Alex in Plano. Hi, Alex.
Hi.
Hi, go right ahead, please.
Oh, okay. Yeah, I have a comment on the title of the book. And, you know, right now the tension between the people and the Chinese government is getting worse and worse. You see the unrest and strikes are everywhere. So, you know, recently, you know, one guy just rushed into a courthouse and killed three judges. And that man who shot three judges are celebrated as a national hero. So I don't think, you know, the government can last a lot long. And, you know, I don't think the Beijing consensus will be dominant force in 21st century. And that's my comment.
Although, if I'm thinking of the right case, Alex, the man who shot the judge, didn't he have an issue over his divorce? Wasn't that his problem?
Oh, that one, okay. I don't really know the whole story, but you see, the people instantly take a side with the man, not on the government side. So that tells, you know, the sentiment in right now in China, I think.
All right, well, let's get a response for you from Stefan. Thank you so much.
Well, your caller, Alex, is pointing to a very interesting phenomenon, which is that we have seen in 2006, 7, and 8 anywhere between 60 and 80,000 public demonstrations each year against the authorities. And what you have are people who are reacting to local government taking land at a cheap price, condemning it, buying it from locals, and then reselling it to developers or people who want to put in factories at a much higher price. And so there's a lot of corruption going on around the country, and people are reacting to it, and there is huge alienation as a result of this. But the central government is moving rapidly to try to address this. Now, you know, it's obviously a work in progress, and you don't know how it's going to turn out. Alex is right. There's certainly a lot of anger out there, and it's not a perfect system by any means. But my point is simply that the central government is, for better or for worse, they seem to be rather flexible, they react quickly, and they have a tremendous security force, which mops up anything that doesn't work voluntarily.
Beyond convincing them to read your book. What do you think is the best way to get U.S. and allied leaders to recognize the problem for what it is and take appropriate actions?
Well, I think that all people need to do is realize, I mean, if the reason that China is so aggressive in acquiring the copper, timber, iron, and energy in these areas beyond the West, these countries around the world, is it desperately needs these resources in order to grow at a rate, namely 8%, more or less 8%, so that it can provide the jobs, the houses, the roads, the infrastructure to support this population. So China cannot really back off of these commercial relationships. It can't change the nature of its relations with Angola or Nigeria or Sudan or whatever. So China is what we see. It is the presence that we actually have described. American businesses attempting to operate across the world have got to be very clear about what they're running into when they attempt to sell projects in Africa and Latin America. They have to be very clear about the way the Chinese are doing business and what it means for local populations. And I think that once you make clear this kind of a challenge, once it finds its way into literature, to radio, TV, and the rest of it, people will begin to talk about it. They'll begin to look for it. And once they do that, it will acquire a life of its own. So that's my hope. My hope was simply, you know, I'm not a pessimist. This is not a fire bell in the night. But it is a warning that we cannot simply ignore this dynamic presentation from China. It's not going away. I mean, they're educating a whole new generation of leaders around the world in these authoritarian values. So we have got to deal with it.
We just have about 20 seconds left. But does the West need to amend the way it sets up requirements when it provides aid and trade deals for the developing world?
It needs to look at that entire process very, very carefully. It has to be more highly targeted, more efficient, more effective. We have to have ways of offering people an alternative to the Chinese model. And we have, above all, to persuade people that democratic freedoms and personal freedoms are very important to a full and decent life on this earth.
Stefan Halper is Senior Fellow in the Department of International Studies at Cambridge and a State Department veteran who served under Presidents Nixon, Ford, and Reagan. His new book is The Beijing Consensus, How China's Authoritarian Model Will Dominate the 21st Century. Steph, it's been a really interesting hour. Thank you so much for joining us.
Chris, thanks for having me. It's been a delight.
My name is Chris Boyd. Thank you for listening and have a great day.
Think production team includes associate producer Betsy Lewis and engineer Nilofer Arsala. Our senior producer is Jeff Whittington. Learn more about today's show, find out about upcoming programs, and download our free daily podcasts at kera.org/think. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@kera.org.